Kannst du mich schauen mit dir, ne?
Seven young people shipwrecked on a mysterious island. The island was deserted. Not even birds or animals dared to come here. What did they find?
Seaweed, fish, and turtle eggs. Anything we can eat, as well as snakes and lizards.
Just let me finish. There's a lot of grass growing around here. You can eat the roots. You can eat the roots of a lot of plants here. Never thought of that, did you?
Never thought of that, did you?
They were driven to the edge of starvation. Food was scarce, and they were forbidden to eat the mushrooms that grew on the island. Fear and hunger turned them against each other.
Can't we eat the mushrooms now?
I'll kill you.
But Tango will help me live.
I haven't been hungry since I left the ship.
Mamie. Oh, help me. Help me.
Please. Can't we eat the mushrooms now?
That would really be the end of us.
Order again, see?
Can they escape the dreaded Matungo? You'll find out when you see Matungo!
Welcome to another installment of the Plants Are People 2 podcast, where we explore botany, plants, sometimes people that suck. Today's show is brought to you by the Church of Fractal Realization. Do you want to feel completely meaningless in a world that expands both inward and outward simultaneously, with no beginning and no end? Let us strip you of the idea that you are somebody and give you the infinite gift of existential nothingness. Don't call us, we'll contact you. I gotta start screening these ads better in the future. Today's show is going to be about Japanese knotweed. That's a big up-and-coming species. If you don't know what it is, you'll learn a little bit about it, although I doubt that anyone in the New England area hasn't heard Japanese knotweed before or had a conversation with somebody about it. It's been snowed here last night, probably have a couple inches on the ground. It's another one of those seasons. I kind of feel bad for people in California and like the western United States or anywhere where there aren't any seasons, really. Luckily, we have infinite seasons here in Vermont. I would call this season that we're in right now, get your shit out of the yard before there's too much snow and you can't find it anymore season. It's hard to, snow makes everything so hard. I'm not really a snow person. I would actually probably do fine living somewhere where it's warmer year round. Liking plants a lot. There's, you know, 6 months here where there isn't really anything growing in the understory of the forest. There are, of course, forest trees and stuff that you could wonder about, but I'm really interested in things that are under the snow and finding new species that way and exploring new things. And the trees are cool, but so that'll probably lead me to taking a few trips here and there over the winter to some warmer places where things are in flower and I can do a little botanizing the way I like to do. Yeah, Japanese knotweed also has a season. And it's a season where the plant is best treated if you're going to try to kill it. Which is really the only route that you can go for the Fallopia species. Fallopia is the genus name. Japonica is the species name. It is in the smartweed family, Polygonaceae. There's a lot of plants in this family. It's originally from Asia, and it seems like it's been slow. It's been here for a long time, but it's slowly been spreading. It spread to Europe, and then it came here, and in Europe, it's, I was reading that it's actually illegal to sell property with Japanese knotweed growing on it, because it's such a nuisance plant that, and it destroys property. There was a statistic in there that said 70 million euro to eradicate 10 acres of Japanese knotweed for the 2012 Olympic Games. That's an insane amount of money for that many acres. I've done it for a lot cheaper in my experience. But so there are three species here, Fallopia species here in Vermont. The one that we're most familiar with, or that you see a lot, is the Japonica species. It sort of has heart-shaped leaves, hollow stems. They're compartmentalized. So if you ever cut one, you can look down inside it and you can see that there's a section of that stem that's hollow to another section that's sort of like closed off. And they hold a lot of water in the base. They look very similar to what bamboo would look like, although they're not related to bamboo at all. They have white flowers. They usually flower in late summer, so August, September. And they're all along the riparian zones in southern Vermont and in northern Vermont. Part of what made that species worse for us here in Vermont was Hurricane Irene. There were a lot of bridges that were out, so there was a lot of flooding that happened, and it basically scoured, you know, upstream where there were some Japanese knotweed populations, scoured those away, and then deposited them along the rivers that flow down to the Connecticut. And Japanese knotweed propagates asexually by cuttings, and the cutting can be very small. You know, I think it's like a quarter inch, but you know, anything that's a half inch or bigger has a, you know, given the right conditions, if it lands on soil and has moisture, it can root right from that cutting and start a whole new plant. And so what we see here is the cobble, anywhere there's sort of a bank on the rivers, there's Japanese knotweed growing. And it's a particularly bad species because it has allelopathic chemicals that it secretes into the soil. And what those do are inhibit the germination of any other seeds. And if you've ever pulled over, or if you have knotweed on your property and look to see what's growing underneath it, it's usually nothing. It's usually devoid of any other plant life. And what that plant is doing is it's ensuring that it has space of its own and inhibiting any other native plants from germinating. Now, in the native place where this plant grows, I would guess that there are other plants that sort of negate that chemical compound that the Japanese knotweed is secreting into the soil so that those seeds can germinate. And, you know, there's also other things. There's natural predators that would be feeding on that plant. Maybe there's something over there that, you know, some sort of herbivore that would be sort of keeping that plant in check, as well as bacteria and fungi in the soil that would have that plant as a host and feed on it and keep it in check. So the invasive plant that's here has none of those checks and takes over and can outcompete native plants rapidly. The areas that they inhabit, the wetlands and the riparian zones, those all happen to be really interesting places to find plants and the places where, you know, it's a less common habitat than, say, the forest, the northern hardwood forest would be, because there's so little of that space for plants that would need that as their habitat to exist. The Japanese knotweed threatening this is a big concern for a lot of people. And it should be a big concern for more people. But it does happen to be one of the sort of like the sexy invasive species, you know, like the World Wildlife Federation picks the panda because it's a big animal and it's cute and, you know, all of that. But the knotweed would probably be that one. And it's probably because we see it a lot. It causes a lot of damage, and it has a really bad reputation. The other species that I've seen in Vermont is the Fallopia sacchalinensis, which is the giant knotweed.
Fallopia sacchalinensis.
And that one I have seen up in Stowe, Vermont, behind the restaurant. It's called the Rusty Nail. Do yourself a favor and don't Google that unless you put restaurant after it. But I was up there for some, I think we were turning around in the parking lot up there for some reason to go visit someone, and we turned around in the parking lot of that restaurant. And the leaves on that plant were, they must have been at least twice the size of the leaves that I'm used to seeing. And so I stopped and looked at it, and I was just blown away. And the plants were 12 or 15 feet tall. I hadn't seen that on the rivers around here before. And there's also there's a hybrid between these two species called Bohemica, and there's some really small taxonomic difference between the hairs on the abaxial surface of the leaf that doesn't occur in the other two species. So that says that they're crossbreeding and creating this hybrid. And who knows, that's kind of a scary thing to think about. But the, you know, for the most part, I thought until recently that the seed viability of these plants was very low, similar to what the seed viability of, say, Phragmites is. And part of that has to do with the way they propagate asexually. I assume that the plants that I was seeing out in the wilds were clones of another plant. The reason why I say this is because at least Fallopia japonica is dioecious, having the male and female flowers on separate plants. And so the majority of the plants that we had here were female and propagating from clones. However, the other giant knotweed is seemingly not dioecious and is monoecious, having both sexes on the planet. And so I think this is, now we're getting viable seed. And it's suspected that, just as somebody should to test the anecdotal evidence of, you know, this plant only propagates one way. I don't know what their name was. There was a study done in New Hampshire where they collected seeds. I read the paper the other day, so it's a little fuzzy in my memory, but from what I remember, they collected seeds off a number of plants in different locations and then tried to germinate those seeds, which makes sense. And what happened was they had 95% germination success. So I suspect that it's from the Monoecious Dioecious conversation and those plants having a little bit different biological reproductive approach and the fact that they're so close that they can hybridize. So that's where I think that seed viability is coming from. I was in college, I don't remember, but in some class we took stems from, and this is something that you could do at home, we took stems from the knotweed. And a word about moving any sort of invasive plant before we go into the experiment. I was at the Putney Co-op the other day, and when I pulled in, somebody had a pickup truck there, and they were probably at somebody's house weeding their garden or whatever. But the back of the pickup truck was full of Oriental bittersweet vines, berries all over it, and, you know, no net or anything over the truck bed, just wide open. Who knows where they were coming from? But please don't move invasive plants from where you're cutting them. There's no benefit to doing that. It's not, even for the landowner, just explain to them that this stuff should just stay here because there's already this plant here, and moving it to some other location only spreads it to that other location and depletes more habitat for all these other cool plants that we should be paying attention to. So don't move invasive plants. The knotweed is particularly bad. So, and a lot of times you see it occurring on septic systems or leach fields or just at a, you know, at a shitty pull-off off some dirt road somewhere where people dump their trash, their yard waste. That's not a good way to dispose of that stuff. If you are going to cut it, it's best to just pile it up. You know, if you're going to use mechanical approaches to controlling Japanese knotweed, it's best to just cut it, put it on something that's impermeable, and let it desiccate. The plants will resprout, and they usually resprout with a lot more stems than they did when they were just growing, you know, a healthy, unstressed life. It's really hard to dig up the roots. All of those things sort of can, if you just leave the plant after you cut it, some of it will die, some of it could start new plants where it sits, so then you increase the number of plants you have next season. Really, the only viable chemical approach I've seen is the chemical one to control it in any meaningful way. But don't move, you know, if you go out and you want to do this experiment, you take some cuttings, just take what you need, leave the rest where it is, take a couple sections, bring it home, take them, put them in a blender, and make a sort of like slurry concentrate with it. And you can put a little bit of water in there. You could make, we did it as concentration, so we did like a 25% solution, a 50% solution, and a 100% solution. I would make, you could cut it 50-50 with water and do it that way. They all have a very similar impact on the seeds you're trying to germinate. Don't use any cool seeds, like get some corn or something, or Monstera, or beans, something that'll germinate really easily. Set up a control group, have one that's just water, do it regularly like you normally would, in a paper towel. Take the 50% knotweed water solution and soak your seeds in it and try to germinate those seeds the same way you would with your control with just regular water. When we did it in the lab, at all concentrations, there was no germination of the bean seeds we were trying to germinate. That is terrible for native plants. I do see plants come back after the knotweed's been removed. 90% of the time, in quantity, it's jewelweed in patients. It's usually the spotted jewelweed. I think it's canadensis, in patients canadensis. The yellow jewelweed I see less frequently. That one is in patients pallida. There's a very pale yellow flower on it. The flowers are similar in size. The leaves on the impatience in Vermont. The orange one, orange spotted canadensis species, they're a little bit darker green, I'd say. The red midvein. The yellow ones, pallida, is a little bit more pale, bluish on the top of the leaf. So it's a little, I've seen them mixed together in different places. Creamery Bridge down in Brattleboro is a good place to see that. There's both species there growing. They're harder to tell apart when they're not in flower, though. But that is, they're an annual, reseeding every year, growing new plants. Not all of the species in that genus are annuals, but these particular ones are. And, they're reseeding themselves. They did that recently, and they have a really interesting seed dispersal method. They sort of had this water pressure built up in their seed pods. If you've ever touched a jewelweed plant when the seeds are mature, you can sort of pick these little pods, and you just put a little pressure on them in your hand, and the seeds wrapped around a little coil, almost like a spring, and when you touch them, they just explode and send seeds everywhere. I'm not sure why the impatience species might have better resistance to the allelopathic chemicals that the Japanese knotweed is secreting into the soil. I'm not sure what the science is behind that. I'd have to look into that. But that would be a cool little science research project for somebody to figure out. Maybe I'll do it sometime and let you know. But so that's a cool experiment you can do just to like understand how Japanese knotweed and these chemicals that the plants are secreting affect native plants and native seed germination. I just remembered, I wanted to say that the other part of this Japanese knotweed seed viability question. If you noticed this season in Vermont, we had an extended nice fall. I would really consider yesterday to be the first snowy day here, and we only got a couple inches. But our season has been lengthening, and previously, if you've noticed Japanese knotweed on the rivers, they're usually the first plant, one of the first plants to get frostbite by the colder weather. the leaves will all turn brown and they'll sort of start dying from the top down. And so that's interesting to think about. If we get an early, because they flower so late in the season, they really need a longer season to develop viable seed. So in conjunction with the monoecious dioecious question, as well as the hybridization of two species and the lengthening of our growing season in New England, maybe we're reaching a point now where the Japanese knotweed can develop viable seed into November and early December, where it wasn't able to do that 100 years ago. And that's going to be a huge hurdle for native plants to overcome. If it's true that there's 95% viability with knotweed seeds as it stands now, that's pretty scary. The other species I see, and I sort of think of this as, I sort of like to, it's fun to take an invasive and then think about what its native counterpart is here, where, you know, the niche that a native plant occupies that the invasive sort of takes over. And it's a really common one. It's called Phytolacca americana, which is pokeberry. I remember seeing it as a kid in eastern Massachusetts, everywhere. I thought it was just, you know, when I was a kid, I probably thought it was just a trash plant with sumac, and, you know, they grew in industrial places, and I sort of grew up around, you know, it's sandy in eastern Mass, so there was pine forest and gravel pits and, you know, sand, sort of like sand dunes that they were harvesting for different things. But that was one of the ones that I would see a lot of, and you would, you know, the berries are very concentrated with the anthocyanic pigment, so when you touch it, your hands just turn purple. And, you know, indigenous peoples probably used it for dyeing clothes, I'm sure they did other things with it too. I think it is poisonous, potentially, unless you, I bet there's some sort of like boiling method where you can eat it. But that one, it looks similar to, it almost looks like the cousin, it could be the cousin of Japanese knotweed. They are not related. Pokeberry, Phytolacca, happens to be in its own family, Phytolaccaceae. And so that has 25 species worldwide. It's in the order Caryophyllales. And there's 25 species native to North America, the Midwest, the South, some in the Far West. Some of them are naturalized in Europe and Asia. It says it's poisonous to humans, dogs, and livestock. But with the proper cooking, they later, what does this say? In the spring and early summer, shoots and leaves, not the root, are edible with proper cooking. So that's like similar to knotweed. People will harvest those in the early spring, the little shoots, pickle them, or I don't know what people do with them. I don't eat them, but they also say that the Japanese knotweed is high in resveratrol. There's been some cancer stuff done with it. I don't pay attention to that stuff in terms of the, I feel like plants for human uses is, I'm just here to appreciate them. I really don't have any ulterior motive in use for plants at all. I just like to explore what they are. So I wouldn't eat any of these things, but feel free to explore it and see if there that's something you want to do. But so Phytolacca americana is a really cool species in the family. There's not really that many. I don't think we have any other species of genera that fall under that family in New England. I'd have to look at the different ones. I don't recognize them any of them offhand, but not a trash plant. Occupies a very similar habit to Japanese knotweed. Could in some ways be considered, if you don't have livestock or little kids or anything, a plant to plant. You know, take the seeds off a plant that's you find growing somewhere else and spread those around and try to have that, you know, after you sort of get the knotweed out of there, occupy that space again. And I'm sure that the berries are good for birds, and there are other insects that will benefit from those plants over the Japanese knotweed. The Japanese knotweed is also, a lot of people think that it's a good like bee crop, and you know, a lot of, all flowers aren't created equal, all plants aren't created equal depending on where they are. The evolution of the insects around us rely on plants that have evolved with them to provide them with what they need in order to be successful and reproduce and feed things up the food chain. And so if we don't, you know, if we just sort of give in to, well, Japanese knotweed is good for honeybees, and you know, it's really not true. To, you know, those honeybees could be, if you gave them some other native plant, they would be going to that. So just giving up and saying that we can't do anything about this, and it's good for honeybees, and I can get resveratrol out of it, and I can eat them in the spring, it's like putting lipstick on a pig. You know, that's not the way that we should be dealing with this issue. We should be trying to restore these habitats and get rid of this invasive plant, which has the potential to really, you know, especially with all this viable seed information coming out recently, to take over even more than it has before. In terms of treatment, back to the seasonality, the knotweed season in Vermont, August, September, is the best time to treat those plants. If you're going to use chemicals and a foliar treatment, the knotweed will respond the best way, the way that you want them to, in terms of dying. In August and September, either right after flowering or during flowering. And what happens is the plant is taking all of its nutrients and bringing it back into its root system at that time. It's starting to end its life cycle for that season, and it's starting to store reserves in order to sprout next season and flower again. So if you can sort of tack on your control method at that time of year, you'll have much better success. The other ways, I used to be friends with this guy. Actually, I have to call him. He called me the other day, and he has me do a little work on his property every once in a while. I haven't talked to him in a little while, but he used to go out. He had knotweed plants. They were probably 4 or 5 inches tall, single leaf or double leaf. It wasn't an extensive infestation by any means. But he would go out there every night, and he just took his golf club with him, his like 9-iron or whatever, and he would just, you know, swing it at the knotweed and sort of like hit it, cut it off at the base over and over. And I think it worked. I think he had good success with that. But it's a lot of different components that feed into that particular suite of methods that he was using. The plants were really small. There weren't very many of them. They were somewhere that was really accessible for him to walk to. He had a tool that made it easy for him to do it. And they weren't established, so he could feasibly control that invasive plant population just by walking out in the yard with a golf club every couple weeks for 20 minutes. Once you get into acres and acres and acres of it, your options go more and more towards chemical control. Mostly for cost. I would actually be interested to see, you know, to ask these people that that spent 70 million euro to eradicate 10 acres for the 2012 Olympic Games, what their control method was. Because, you know, if you went in there with, I don't even know how you would spend that much money. It just seems absolutely crazy to spend that much money to get knotweed off of 10 acres. The size of your infestation, if it's really big, you're going to have to do it with chemical control. If you have a couple plants, they're small, and, you know, by small, maybe they're, you know, 10 stems and they're up to your chest, you can try digging that out and putting it on a wooden pallet somewhere above the ground where it won't root again, and try to kill it that way, and then monitor where you dug it up for either germinating seeds or sprouts off any roots that you didn't get. In terms of having an excavator or something come in and dig up a huge parcel to get all that stuff out of there, I don't know, maybe it'll work. It's probably going to be a lot more expensive than doing it with a little bit of chemical and, having 90% of it dead the next season. Just the amount of time that you would have to put into controlling it would be a lot less. And then, of course, if you do that, where you're removing them, putting seeds down of something else that can occupy that space, to hopefully outcompete the invasive plant and give you some native plants for that section of property that you have. But if anyone wants to reach out to me and ask me about their specific issue, I'm happy to do that. You can either find me on Instagram, plants.people.r.2 T-O-O, and send me a message, and I'll respond and probably ask you a few questions about what you have and try to help you out. So that's Japanese knotweed in a nutshell. It's a terrible thing that we're dealing with, but there's ways to handle it, and being aware of what plants you have on your property is probably the best thing you can do as a landowner. If you know that you have invasives, that's half the battle, and then figuring out a plan by contacting someone and asking them how to do it, or just reading about it on your own. There's a lot of misinformation out there, but there's also a lot of good information, and if you can sort of discern the good from the bad, you'll be in a much better place. Also, reaching out to your local state extension office about invasive plants. Every state has a noxious plant list available online somewhere. Check it out. See what invasive plants are around you, what they look like. Try to find one and learn about them, and learn about how they affect the native plants in your area and what you can do. There'll be volunteer days, pulling garlic mustard or something. Go out there, help some people, see some plants, see some cool habitats, some native plants, hopefully, and, you know, you'll be helping to restore some sort of parcel of land in your community where invasive plants have taken over. And just as a note, the Japanese knotweed is listed by the World Conservation Union as the world's worst invasive species. So it's not just me that's saying it. There's somebody else out there that's saying it too, and they're the World Conservation Union. So we'll shift gears a little bit. Last episode we talked about a little starter course in growing cannabis, and I wanted to give a little update on my plants. I have, what I have right now is two feminized seed. I bought 20 seeds from Ethos Genetics. I bought Strawberry Cookies OG and a strain called Crescendo, which is a back cross of a few of their other strains. But so those are probably, at least in name, the best seeds that I've bought without having actually grown them or tried them at all. So they've been, I planted them in early November, so they're a couple weeks in right now. They're about maybe 6 or 7 inches tall. And so I bought feminized seeds, and what my plan is to grow these out. I'm going to clone them before I flower them, and I'm going to then take those flowers, dry them, cure them, go through that process, try them. Hopefully they're good, and I've saved a clone of them and been growing that clone alongside the flowering plants under different light cycles, but, you know, in the same area. And, you know, if those are good, I'm going to take my clones off those plants and then plant those clones as my outdoor grow and try to do it that way. The seeds that I wanted to talk a little bit about, purchasing seeds. It was kind of a brief overview last time, but there's a few different kinds of seeds that you'll see when you look on a website or somebody selling seeds will have. There's regular seeds. That means that you have the possibility of getting males and females in that seed batch when you plant them. The other one is feminized seed, which is there's like 95% chance you're going to get all females when you plant those seeds. The regular feminized autoflowers. Autoflower seeds don't go on the same light cycle that regular photoperiod seeds do. So you can have autoflower regular seeds and autoflower feminized seeds. The autoflowers have the benefit of you never have to change your light cycle. So you could put them under an 18-6, 18 on, 6 off light cycle inside. You could put them outside in May and just let them run. They'll be done flowering. You know, they have a really short flowering time. Basically, that strain or that hybrid that we have now is from a ruderalis. It was called Cannabis ruderalis, Siberia. So the light cycles up there are very different than what we're used to in living in, like, the United States. Alaska experiences this, but they have extended periods of light, and so evolutionarily cannabis, there was a gene that was selected for in the DNA of that plant over time to not worry about photoperiod and when the light cycle changes and just flower no matter what. So they, breeders over time, have taken that Ruderalis species and crossed it into the regular photoperiod plants. And what happens is you get a bunch of different varied genetics in your seeds. You would have some plants that are more photoperiod and not as autoflower, and then you'd have plants that are very autoflower and not as photoperiod. The other thing that they were trying to have happen here was that the Ruderalis species, the original ones, were very poor in quality of the cannabis, so they were not really smokable. And we had the photoperiod plants that were really smokable, and so by crossing them in, you had to do a lot of work to get there, but eventually you get to smokable autoflower plants, you know, that can yield really well, similar to what a photoperiod plant does, but you planted that seed and had, you know, things hanging up, drying in 50 days or less. Sometimes they're 45 days. And so what's been happening in the cannabis culture right now is that you can sort of interlace these autoflower seeds into your normal growing routine and be harvesting sort of like in between harvests. So you could plant autoflower seeds in May and have a harvest sort of in like July, and you'd plant them alongside your photoperiods in May, but those photoperiods are just going to go until October. And so if you plant the autoflowers, you'd have a harvest in July, and then if you plant another string of autoflowers, you know, you'd have another harvest in like September, and then you'd have your photoperiod harvest. You can also do it in your grow tent inside. If you're doing a veg room and you're going to veg your plants under an 18-6 light cycle for a long time, you can just throw in some autoflowers and they will grow and flower in a very short amount of time, and then you would still have your regular photoperiod plants going as well. So I wanted to give the rundown on sort of what's out there in terms of seeds. And I said last time, you know, the genetics are really important. And if you think about what plants are, way more complicated than we are, humans, in terms of how many DNA sequences are on their helix. And by that I mean, there's a lot more, there's just a lot more stuff going on in plants, and they have a lot, you know, they process differently than we do, and they have a lot of different, they can make their own food, their own chemicals, I think that we're a much inferior, a highly inferior species to plants in general. And it just, the amount of time that plants have been evolving, it's mind-blowing to even think that humans are anywhere near the, you know, the level of perfection that plants are at in terms of what they do and interact with their environment. And it's, we're just terrible. But so the genetics in cannabis, if somebody had a plant that they really liked and they crossed it with this other plant, you know, just because it was a male and they wanted seed, the progeny of that cross, that male and female pollination event, the seeds are going to be all over the place. And if you've ever done a Opponent Square, it's basically, you think about it like a male and a female have 10 kids. All of those kids are going to look different. And some will look more like the mother, some will look more like the father. If there was intention behind that, you might be able to steer what those offspring look like. If you're just doing it, you know, the female plant that you really like with any male plant that you pick up, who knows what the lineage is behind that male plant and what you're putting into your progeny of that that pollination that you had occur. And so it takes time, and that's generally how you start. You cross a male and a female, you get all your seeds, you plant them, and then you do the hunt, the quote-unquote hunt, for the plants that look like what you're looking for, what you're trying to find. And, you know, that could be 1,000 seeds or 1,500 seeds to find the one plant that you're looking for in that cross. So if you get seeds from somebody and they're just like, oh yeah, these are this, be wary of, you know, at least have low expectations of what you're going to actually grow, because the likelihood of them actually being what this person thinks it is fairly low, unless they're, you know, you've seen their mother plants and they know they've got a male in reserve somewhere that nobody else uses except them, and that's the male that they're putting on all of their females all the time to put out seed. But with, you know, and it generally takes 4 generations of crossing to get to somewhere where you can hand somebody a pack of seeds that you crossed and say, these are going to look like this, and show them, you know, the mother plant or the plant that you're using as the archetype for that name that you're giving it. And it's a long process, and it's a lot, you know, you can sort of pay the money just to skip there and buy seeds from somebody that is trusted and has a reputation and grow those seeds and be happy with what you get. We're slowly coming down to the last few minutes in my hour. I want to give one, you know, I guess it's a slam. I try not to slam people too often, but it's just something that's been, I don't know, it's been in my face lately, and I've noticed it before, and I've just really sort of like tried not to pay attention to it, but it's everywhere. And there's this culture of like plant, I don't know what it is really. It's like Monstera deliciosa, and any of the monsteras really. I'm sick of seeing them on Instagram and all over the place. Like, why is this plant so popular? Like, what is it about? I don't get it. Apparently maybe I'm missing something, but to me, there's so many other interesting plants that somebody could be growing in their house as a house plant. I like house plants. I have house plants. I have patchouli growing in here, and some weird lime-scented geranium, and a mimosa species, and Ignatia, and some, like, Ripsalis, rat-tail cactuses, and I even have a Phalaenopsis. Like, I get plants. I get having them in the house. I just don't understand what it is about the Monstera that everybody likes. And everybody posts it on Instagram like it's some mind-blowing thing that they've, like, figured this out. Like, I wish they would end. I wish they would stop the Monstera grotesqueness that is all over hashtag plants or whatever. It's just find something more interesting than that. Learn how to grow it. Buy the seeds. Grow it from seed. And it will have way cooler flowers than that thing. And the leaves on it will probably be cooler too. But stop doing Monstera. It's not good for anybody. There's a bunch of other plants out there. Explore your options. You can do better than what everybody else is doing. That's my PSA for the day. Thanks for listening. I really appreciate anyone that's tuning in, downloading the show. If you want to get a hold of me, find me on Instagram, Plants Are People Too. I'm sure there's other ways to get a hold of me if you're savvy enough to figure them out. But yeah, hope you guys are having a good day. I'll see you later.